the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Now, it's not often that our former Taoiseach decide to write their political memoirs. Last one to do so, I think, was Bertie Ahern. But now Leo Varadkar has done so, and he has just published his book, and he joins us about 18 months after he stepped down as Taoiseach. Thank you very much for joining us.
Not at all. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
There's so much I want to get through. I don't know if we'll have enough time. We haven't agreed beforehand what the topics of conversation are, in case anyone thinks so. I may put an emphasis on things you don't want to. It's very possible we won't get to the things you'd like to talk about. But I want to start with, just before you became Fine Gael leader and Taoiseach, you had launched a campaign as Minister for Social Protection against social welfare fraud. And then when you made your pitch to become leader of Fine Gael, you started talking about representing the people who get up early in the morning. And that was used then by a number of people to sort of paint you as a far-right, Thatcherite type of economic person. When you look back at your time in government as Taoiseach and Taoiseach, did you actually deliver for those people who get up early in the morning, or did you step back from it? Were you sort of pushed back from that?
No, I believe I did. Not to the extent that I would have liked to. But, you know, just to give you one or two small examples as to how I believe we did. You know, I really pushed very hard to make sure that there were tax packages in every budget. So, you know, the point at which you pay the high rate of income tax is now 42,000 a year. Back then it was 33 or 34 or something. So, you know, a lot more people can earn a lot more money before they hit the high rate of tax. And then when we brought in new benefits, I was very insistent that they not be means tested, that people who are middle class, people who are working would also get them. So hot school meals, free school books, parental leave, the energy credits when they were brought in those budgets. And then also extending social insurance benefits to self-employed people, you know, bringing back the eye tests and the, you know, the scale and polish of teeth. And then, you know, self-employed people can now qualify for benefits like job seekers, and also what's called the pay-related benefits. People who've been paying PRSI into the system now get a higher benefit if they lose their job or if they need to initially. So yeah, they're the kind of things.
Yeah, but weren't they all a bit of tinkering around the edges? Because what many of our listeners we know over the years, and this has come up during general election campaigns, really don't like the universal social charge, for example, which was brought in by Brian Lenihan at a time of crisis. And the crisis passed and the economy recovered and people still pay the USC. And it's only been tinkered with. It's been reduced marginally. And it means that the personal income tax rates that people pay are way higher than they would have been before the crash 15 years ago. And the impression you would have created is that you wanted to get income tax rates down sharply. Yet in every budget under your leadership, the spending was much bigger than the income tax reductions.
Yeah, well, you know, I suppose just give you the second part of the answer. Did I do as much in that space as I would like to have done? No, we 20% of the vote and we were part of a coalition. And there's only so much you can ever get done. And when you are in a coalition, you know, there are limitations to it. So, yes, I think I did deliver on that to the extent that I had hoped to or wanted to. No, and that was limited by the mandate that we had. Bear in mind what some of that spending was on. Free GP care for kids up to the age of 8. And the kids, you know, the kids from families that were on social welfare were getting it anyway. You know, this was entirely for working people, middle class people.
Also for rich people who probably didn't need it.
And for rich people who happen to pay an awful lot of income tax. And part of my philosophy is that I don't like a society that's divided into people who pay a lot of income tax and get very few benefits, and then people who don't pay any income tax at all and get lots of benefits. I think that's bad for our society, and I think that's unfair. And that's why we tried to make sure that both on the tax side, in terms of the tax packages, and on the spending side, that we were bringing in things that were across the board. The subsidised childcare, for example, would be another example.
But you write in the book about how your ideology sort of evolved over the years as you matured as a person. But does that still come back to sort of key thing for you, that you do think that there is a difference between people who sort of live up to their responsibilities and others who claim rights and don't necessarily work enough for them or contribute enough in society for them?
Yeah, well, look, I think it takes all types of people to make up the world. It takes all types of people to make up a country. And I fully appreciate that people make contributions in different ways. You know, people who are carers might not get paid a salary or have a formal employment, but they make an enormous contribution to our society. And there are, of course, other people who can't, you know, because they may have, you know, a serious intellectual or physical disability. So, you know, I totally get that at the outset, and I always did. But it's important to state that. But I do think that there are, you know, a fair number of people in our society. I'm sure they're not the majority. I'm sure they're a minority who would be very quick to tell you the rights and entitlements that they think they should have, but would be very slow to tell you how much they contribute or how much they think they should contribute to the cost of providing those things. And to have a society like we have, and we have a great society in Ireland, you know, compared to most countries in the world and even most countries in Europe, you know, that all comes at a cost. And, you know, you can't have pensions that are anyway decent. You can't have a good education system like we have. You can't have a health service, you know, which is now showing real improvements, you know, in terms of patient outcomes and so on, if you're not contributing to them. And it's not good enough for me to say, you know, somebody else should pay for all these things. You have to be willing to contribute yourself.
You're now a middle-aged man in your mid-40s, but you came into government office as a young man and became our youngest ever Taoiseach. Do you think that as a representative of younger generations, you did enough for younger generations, given that we now see that 3 in 5 of the under 24s are talking of emigrating, that we have so many deeply unhappy people in their 20s, 30s and 40s who feel they're never going to have the opportunity to own their own home?
Yeah, well, look, there's a lot to unpack there. You know, I was TD for Dublin West for everyone who voted for me and Taoiseach of the country. You know, I never set out to be, you know, to represent a particular generation. I think in some areas we've done very well. You know, if you take areas like education, for example, you know, in many surveys, Ireland being the best or one of the best educated countries in the world, and helped to bring down the cost of education as well in a number of different ways. You know, for young women and young LGBT people, have rights and freedoms that were not there 10 years ago, would have been imaginable 20 years ago. On housing, no, obviously not. You know, that's an area that has got worse. Notwithstanding the fact we now have close to record numbers of first-time buyers now every week, the demand for housing, the demand for people to become a homeowner, outstrip supply, and we never successfully got on top of that.
I want to ask you more about the housing and emigration, but I suppose the emigration ties into this point I want to put to you, that you were a member of that younger generation, and it is said that post the crash, we now have a generation that is not going to enjoy the same living standards as their parents did before them. And that is why many people have emigrated and are thinking of emigrating. And that the recovery from the crash was not about setting about new opportunities for the next generation. It was about restoring money and wealth for those who had lost during the crash. I mean, even yourself, you famously had bought an apartment during the boom, the Celtic Tiger boom. And presumably that recovered in value before you sold it, did it, as a result of the recovery in the economy?
It did eventually, after quite some time. I was in negative equity for a long period, and I haven't sold it yet. The rent just about covers the mortgage, but like, I'm not complaining about that. That's a better
place
to be.
And it's worth something. It's worth something to you.
Yes, when the mortgage paid off,
But so that happened is a certain generation had a recovery, but the generation coming behind, to an extent, is paying for that.
I think, I wouldn't necessarily characterise it the way you're characterising it, but you know, I accept that the housing situation is extremely difficult for people who are now in their 20s and 30s, and in some cases much older. You know, I wouldn't say it was ever easy. You know, I grew up in the 1980s when not only were huge numbers of people emigrating, and they didn't come back, generally speaking, which is a very different type of emigration than we have now. You know, there was 20% unemployment, and I remember my parents buying a house in the Manchester area and paying interest rates of 14 or 21%, you know, so the actual value of the house might've been low, but
they paid expensively in their monthly mortgage.
And, you know, my dad was, we were relatively affluent. My dad was a doctor, no new car for 7 years, no foreign holiday, wasn't on the cards. So, you know, I think it's incorrect to say that, you know, one generation ago or two generations ago, it was really easy to be a homeowner. That's not true. And if you go back three generations ago, the actual level of home ownership back then was lower than it was now. So, you know, I think those things can be made a bit too simple.
Although the state did a much better job, didn't it, in previous generations of providing social and affordable housing?
At certain periods, yeah. And I don't know if you ever follow David Higgins, a very interesting guy on Twitter. And
economist.
He did this graph on his garden wall where he shows the rate of what the average house price costs relative to your average income. And over the past decades, it's ranged between four times the average income and eight times the average income. It actually was worse than it was now, believe it or not. in terms of the cost of a house relative to the average income, and that's the real figure.
Yeah,
but it's also been a lot better at certain periods too.
When people couldn't afford to buy their own homes, they found it easier to find social housing, or they could afford rental accommodation at a price that was fair enough to allow them to save to go and buy their own house. And people who are renting now are screwed in that regard, aren't they?
And that is a difference now. I no longer speak for the government, but what are the kind of things that have been done in the meantime to try and deal with that? Like one is the creation of cost rental housing, you know, a new form of public housing that did not exist before, started off by Owen Murphy, is now very much a reality now under this government. And the other thing is ramping up social housing again. So I accept we have a bigger population now, but notwithstanding that, the number of new social homes being built every year is now at its highest since the 70s. And actually one thing Fine Gael did in its period in government, and a lot of people wouldn't know this, the number of people who are in social housing, and I mean social housing, by the way, I don't mean HAP, the number of people who are in social housing, public housing, not only increased in raw numbers, increased in percentage terms based on the last census. And that's something people wouldn't necessarily believe happened, but did. Was it anyway near enough? Was the scale of the response close to what was required to get on top of it? No, it wasn't. And that work obviously continues.
And in the book, you do praise things like your establishment of the Land Development Agency, and you talk it up. But only last week, the Department of Finance said that the Land Development Agency will make only a minor contribution to the government housing targets.
Yeah, and look, you wouldn't be surprised to hear that the Land Development Agency and the Department of Housing dispute that. So we'll let them argue that one out.
But it hasn't been a success. It hasn't. In 7 years since it was set up, it has only brought about a few thousand houses in which people live, houses and apartments.
It was extremely slow to get going.
Well, why? You were the Taoiseach at the time when it was getting going.
Yeah, I honestly don't know why, and that's a fair question. I could give you an answer, but I can't tell you for sure that that's the correct answer. But what I would say, though, and I remember being at the launch, and we did it on the roof of Áras Fictormida, you know, the big building over Bosáras overlooking the city. Me and Owen Murphy announced that, you know, conceded that the first LDA homes wouldn't be until 2020 and that it would be a ramp up. And I said that I felt that, you know, this new government agency was going to be as significant to housing as the IDA was to industrial development or Aer Lingus was to aviation.
And it hasn't been.
But go back over the history of those organisations, Aer Lingus and IDA, very slow start for the first 5-10 years. But would anyone now doubt that the establishment of those semi-states, those state bodies, was a game changer?
Well, let me just ask you one more thing about housing, because it did strike me reading through the book as well that you said at one stage yourself and your partner Matt decided you wanted to get away from apartment living and buy your own house. And yet an awful lot of policy since going back to the time Fine Gael came into power in 2011 has been towards apartments. So why push on apartments when it doesn't seem necessarily to fit the Irish psyche that people want, as you've expressed in the book, a desire for a house with a back garden?
Yeah, well, look, I lived in an apartment for a very long time, and, you know, I was very happy living in that apartment for a very long time. But, you know, priorities change and life changes. And we need a good mix of housing in Ireland. And actually, you know, if you look at what we have in Ireland, the biggest deficit that we have, the biggest deficiency that we have is of one-bed units. And so very often they're the ones that face the largest number of objections. But, you know, there are actually a lot of single people. There are migrants who come to the country for, you know, a period of time and then move on. People need to get settled. And so much of Ireland and so much of the city of Dublin in particular is low density. three-bed, four-bed houses. And yeah, we need more of them. But what is most efficient is actually apartments and one-beds. But it's a case of, you know, we're deficient by several hundred thousand in terms of the number of housing units we need. And, you know, we need a lot more of all of them, quite frankly.
I deliberately stayed with housing because I think it's one of the most important things from your time as Taoiseach. But there are other things that I want to talk about after the break. And I also want to, because it is relevant to your successor, who's now the Taoiseach, Simon Harris, I want to talk about personal safety and anti-immigration sentiment as well that you've experienced and the country is. And we'll get to all of that after the break. Welcome back. Leo Varadkar is with us after the publication of his memoir, Speaking My Mind. And there was a little footnote on one of the pages, Leo, which really caught my attention. And it said, I preferred not to know the details of any specific threats against me unless it was absolutely necessary. But I do know that there were regular, credible and regular threats to kidnap, injure or kill me, some of which the Gardaí deemed credible. Tell us a little bit more about that, because you did talk as well about the night of the Dublin riots when you were told not to return to your own home because it might not be safe.
Yeah, so, you know, people can make death threats and threats of violence all the time, you know, and they do, and they do to all sorts of people, and they're not necessarily credible. But threats that would be deemed credible would be if they were coming from, you know, let's say somebody who had a history of violence, you know. You know, I remember one guy had a conviction for threatening his neighbour with a chainsaw, and because of that, the Gardaí considered it to be a more credible threat than if it just came from, you know, some crank online, or if people were coordinating, you know, on certain apps and so on, it would be deemed to be more credible. So on the night of the riots, a lot of the coordination around that happened on certain apps, and, you know, people were encouraged to convene on my house and also another house where they got the address wrong for, by the way. So thankfully, whoever lives there didn't experience anything on account of me. But, you know, the backdrop to that was generally I asked my staff, or as a general policy, I asked my staff and the Gardaí not to inform me of the threats. I didn't want to know. Didn't want to be distracted.
Were you in any way fearful?
Fearful? Only very rarely. You know, there were one or two instances, you know, where I was sort of, you know, there's one on Dunleary Pier, you know, where a guy just kind of came out of nowhere and pushed me or whatever. And, you know, I probably would have been fine. You know, I'm a big guy. I can probably look after myself. But if he'd have had a knife or something, it could have been dangerous. But, you know, thankfully the Gardaí were there.
You see, I brought it up because we've seen Simon Harris very upset last week about what's happened. And I think, made possibly worse for him, that there have been threats made against his children and against other family members as well. Did it in any way contribute to your sense of unhappiness which led to your decision to give up politics?
Yeah, and look, there were threats against some of my family members too, including my sister in London, you know, so you'd be amazed how far people can reach. And obviously then the Met in London had to get involved in that and so on. You know, again, sort of took the view as well that I didn't want to complain about it or talk too much about it in public. You know, number one, because I didn't want to give those people the satisfaction of thinking that I was in any way bothered by them. Secondly, very aware that we live in a society where, you know, people are not politicians are subject to violence. You know, the extent to which we've an epidemic of violence against women in Ireland is truly shocking.
And yet there are people who use that as a way to try and blame migrants, as if we wouldn't have any problems at all if it wasn't for all those migrants that you left into the country.
Yeah, well, look, you know, people are entitled to have their views on migration. And I don't think that, you know, people can't have, you know, people can take the view that we should have less immigration, more immigration, different types. Totally respect that. But what I see, which to me is the racist end of that, is where no matter what the social problem is, it gets blamed on migrants. So, you know, in Ireland, often you'll see the housing crisis being blamed on the migrants, even though it's often migrants that are building the new houses. Or you'll see, you know, crime being blamed on migrants. Or you'll see people who only take an interest in violence against women when the perpetrator is a foreigner. and take absolutely no interest in it when the victim is a foreigner or the perpetrator is not a foreigner. That's the racist end of being against immigration.
But
you can be against immigration and not a racist, and I think it's important to acknowledge
yeah,
that.
Yeah, would you worry, though, that we could end up finding ourselves going down the route of other countries, particularly when you see that major demonstration in London over the weekend organised by the likes of Stephen Yaxley Lennon, who performs under the name Tommy Robinson.
His real name isn't English enough, apparently.
Yeah. Do you think, is it that, you know, we might get people like that in Ireland, and would you be confident that the Irish people just won't stand for that type of nonsense?
Look, Ireland's a normal country, and what happens in other European countries can happen here too. You know, I remember people used to think that Sweden was a sort of a, you know, liberal come social democratic paradise that would never tolerate such a thing. And then one day people woke up and found the Sweden Democrats were the second biggest party in that country. So, you know, can that happen here? Yes, it can. I would hope that the purchase for those kind of views would be less in Ireland, largely because of, you know, the acknowledgement of our own history. The fact that so many people in Ireland have emigrated, so many people in Ireland have relatives that live abroad. You know, I have family in London, I have family in the United States. You know, they're only there because they left Ireland for lots of different reasons, you know, at different times. And I'd hope that we as a country, because of our own national story, we'll have a little bit of a better understanding of what migration is about and what it isn't. I think that'll be the case. But, you know, that's not to say that there isn't a gap in the market for I don't like using the term far right, because, you know, what we see rising around the world is white supremacist Christian nationalism. Is there a market for that in Ireland? Yeah, there is. I don't know how big it is, though, and I don't think it's as big as it would be in the UK or the US.
What does that make you feel like, though, given that the social progress that you referred to earlier and all the referendums that we had in relation to things like marriage equality and abortion, do you feel that we're also having what might be regarded as a backlash against woke, and that you would be considered this very woke figure who led a lot of these things?
Yeah, when I'm not being considered Thatcherite, I'm being considered woke. Like, you just can't win sometimes. It's interesting to go back to what the origin of the term woke is. And it actually goes back to the civil rights era in the US, and people were told to be woke. And what it essentially meant was to just be aware that social, racial and gender injustice is all around us. So if you go into a meeting and all the speakers are men and it's the women making the tea, if you go into a room or a restaurant and you notice all the customers are white and all the servers are brown or something akin to that, you know, be aware that that's actually not normal. And that's what being woke is about. So, you know,
and is
I'm
anti-
guilty if I, yeah. if that's what it means.
Is the anti-woke backlash essentially racist?
No, not necessarily. I think the anti-woke thing, and anti-woke is now an identity politics in its own right. These people give out about identity politics. Being anti-woke is now an identity. There are more people who go around saying they're anti-woke than there are people who say they're woke. So, you know, it's very definitely an identity thing in me. I think when people say that they're against woke, what they kind of mean is that they're against, you know, whatever liberal or left cause is fashionable at the moment. And, you know, that can range from people who want to turn the clock back and, you know, ban abortion again and, you know, end same-sex marriage and, you know, reassign women to traditional gender roles. Or it can also mean people who just think the social change has gone far enough and, you know, wanted to settle for a while. And that's quite a broad spectrum.
There's some very interesting passages in the book about your experience of coming out and also how it changed you as a person and also changed your approach to politics. Is there a strange paradox there perhaps in that you mightn't have ever become Taoiseach if you hadn't actually publicly addressed your sexuality and come out, but yet that when you did, the release that it caused may have in some respect dulled your ambition in relation to politics?
Yeah, look, yeah, I guess so. Look, who knows, you know.
Well, you sort of imply that in the book.
Maybe I would have become Taoiseach anyway. Maybe I would have been the first Would I become the first single man to become Taoiseach? I don't know.
Or become the first Taoiseach to come out while in office, rather than being the minister coming out in office.
Maybe I'd still be there. Who knows? But look, who knows? That's the funny course of life that weaves in different directions.
Yeah, but when you were writing the book, how often did you actually look at various crossroads in your life and wonder, what if you had picked the other path?
I often wonder about the counterfactual, like the one that, you know, ones that I would often have thought about is, had elections happened at different times, you know, at least for the first kind of 2 years, even 3 years of my leadership of Fine Gael and as Taoiseach, you know, my personal ratings were well into the 50s. My party was well ahead in the polls. You know, had the election come sooner, would I have won a 5-year mandate? Had we had an election just after the first phase of the pandemic, you know, we might have had different results. Had Fine Gael not had such a bad election in 2002, I probably wouldn't have been a TD in 2007 because there wouldn't have been a vacancy. And then maybe I would have got into the Dáil later, become leader in opposition, you know, so look, who knows? And it's in the kind of, you know, coulda, woulda, shoulda space. And it's interesting to talk about, but, you know, it's not how life works. And one thing I often say to people, particularly, you know, young people and students when I'm asked for advice, one thing I always say is opportunities arise when they do, not when they suit. And you're better off to seize the chance when you can.
Okay. Would you regard Brexit, a successful conclusion to Brexit, as your biggest achievement in politics? Because it does get a lot of attention in the book, but also potentially your biggest disappointment in that the electorate didn't seem to actually care too much.
Look, I don't know what my biggest achievement was. Thanks for acknowledging that there were achievements, by the way, from the way some people recently have written, you'd swear there are none, and dare I even suggest there were any.
But is that hurtful to you? Do you feel, no, you don't care?
No, God, no.
Why not?
I think I'm kind of beyond that now. You know, I was in politics for 20 years. I loved it for most of those 20 years. I worked hard. I made my contribution. I changed the things I could. And, you know, where I didn't succeed, I'm now have a better understanding as to why things are the way they are. And whoever is in the job now, from whatever party, I really wish them the best. And I wish only success for the country.
Do you have one particular regret? One thing that
it's kind of a general one, and it's that maybe I wasn't as optimistic as I should have been about how quickly the economy would bounce back, not just on one occasion but on three. So, you know, the bounce back after the financial crash was way better than people thought. Like, nobody thought, you know, the economy would be humming again by 2014. Brexit, in part because of the deal we were able to negotiate, didn't become a major hit in the economy. And then we bounced back from COVID very quickly. Look at France, still hasn't bounced back from the economic damage of COVID. And had I known that, I think we would have ramped up capital spending sooner, made some investment decisions sooner. And I'm not saying that we'd have a perfect transport system and no housing crisis or anything like that, but some of those problems, you know, I think we wouldn't be as bad as they are now. We would have a better dent in them.
Just a couple of quick questions to finish. Do people have realistic expectations of their politicians and what governments can achieve?
I think they have high expectations and they're right to have high expectations. Are they realistic? Like, I can't speak for 3 million voters. But if people think that there is a country in the world that has a government that's solved all those countries' problems, that doesn't exist. We will always live in a country that has some sort of problem or some sort of crisis going on.
And you write in the book that you're happy that you made the decision and haven't had any regrets. Were there no moments along the way when you thought, I should have just stuck it out, I should have hung in there?
No, and I thought there would be. You know, I was psychologically prepared for, you know, turning on the TV and, you know, seeing Micheál Martin or Simon Harris doing something and me thinking that was supposed to be me. And no, it really didn't happen. Maybe I'm in my honeymoon now. It might happen yet. But
there are so many other things that I would have liked to have had the time to talk to you about. Unfortunately, today here in The Last Word, we haven't had that opportunity. But thank you for coming in. And it's a very, very interesting read. I know you're not too concerned about what people said to it. It's getting mixed reviews from some of your critics.
Yeah, that's
to be expected. Speaking my mind, Leo Varadkar, thank you very much for joining us.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.